Serial Killing, a podcast, is researched, written, produced, and hosted by me, Alyssa Carroll. This is an independent production, no network, no contracts, and I need your support. Please subscribe, follow on my socials linked below, or go to my Patreon to show your support. Thank you so much.
Hi, listeners. I'm Vanessa Richardson, host of the podcast Serial Killers. Like many of you, I'm fascinated by the darker side of humanity. What causes someone to develop such deadly desires and why they decide to act on them? For the past 6 years, I've been able to explore these curiosities weekly, tapping into the mental states of the world's most notorious killers, examining their backgrounds and habits, searching for answers. If you haven't had a chance to check out our show, there's truly no better time to dive in. With hundreds of episodes to binge and new ones released weekly, Serial Killers is the perfect podcast for any avid true crime fan. Follow Serial Killers on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts.
From about 15 years on up, a great deal of my thoughts were basically unshareable.
We are all evil in some form or another. Yes, I am evil. Not 100%, but I am evil.
My mother was a sick, angry, hungry, and very sad woman. I hated her, but I wanted to love my mother.
This is Serial Killing, a podcast.
Hello again, and welcome to Serial Killing, a podcast, where we sometimes veer off the serial killer path to delve into other topics within our beloved true crime community. Special thanks to my patrons, as always, who voted for this episode and who get early access to each podcast. So thank you so much. You are truly appreciated. So today's podcast is coming with a huge, massive disclaimer, as in my old school disclaimer, right? So I'm not joking. This episode is going to talk about the abuse of children, and I mean nearly the worst of the worst. I even have a hard time with this guy and a few others, and I can usually stomach my way through some super disturbing stuff. I experienced enough as a child myself, and that is what drives me to tell even these horrific stories, because I think it is just as important to expose the absolute level of depravity some people have when it comes to, you know, how they use and abuse children for their own gratification. We as a society really need to keep an eye on these children if their parents won't. It's disgusting. I try to stay professional about these things, but sometimes, especially when it comes to this subject, it's kind of hard. So needless to say, this podcast will be disturbing, no doubt about it. So if you want to tap out, not a single one of us will blame you, as in at all. But if you are sticking around, buckle up, Buttercup, because today's podcast will be about the child predator Ian Watkins. The largest source of my information comes from court documents regarding his trial and interviews with former bandmates, along with just general easy stuff to find. So let's jump right in.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So Ian David Carslake Watkins was born on July 30th, 1977 in Merthyr Tydfil, Wales. In the time that I had to dig, I could find absolutely nothing about his biological father. The only thing I found was that his bio father had died when he was about 5 years old from epilepsy. That's it. And for me, that's really disappointing because I was thinking perhaps that might answer some questions as to biology, inherited stuff, all the things. Because this case, I need all the things. I need all the information. You guys know. So his mother is Elaine. I don't really feel the need to get into specifics about her past because there's just nothing there that I found, and she's not the focus. She is innocent. But at some point, after Ian's father died, Elaine met a man named John Davies, who was 7 years her junior. Now, John was a church minister, and the two got married when Ian was 8 years old. And I also found, kind of late in my research, that Ian has a sister named Lisa, and I believe they share the same biological father, and if so, I also believe she is the next younger sister. Do not hold me to that, but I know that there is a sister. So, but anyway, as far as John goes, I'm not sure if John was already living in Pontypridd and Elaine and Ian moved there to be with him, or if they as a kind of newly formed family all moved there, but Ian would finish his school there. They lived in the minister's house provided to ministers. We see those. And fun fact, Pontypridd means bridge by the earthen house, which I absolutely love. I have some Welsh roots, and I'd love to see it someday. But a former bandmate stated that he remembers that Ian was a happy kid who could be quiet and reserved throughout much of his younger years. I mean, he was. It was said that again, Ian and his mother were very, very close. There was some mention of how Elaine could have possibly, you know, over-coddled or over-indulged him due to the death of his father and just wanting to make sure that he felt whole and secure and loved, you know. But, you know, it was said that she gave him everything that he wanted. Now, when Ian was 12 years old, a younger brother, Daniel, was born to the couple, although one source said that Daniel was already John's son before Elaine. I don't know, but there's a younger brother. His name is Daniel. Hashtag leave him alone. So this is a total of two younger siblings that I could find. Now, all sources say that Ian had a rather idyllic childhood in the grand scheme of things. So even though his stepfather was a minister, he was not expected to, or at least excessively pressured into being super religious. He was given the freedom to believe what he wanted. Very specific childhood information about Ian is scarce to say the least, though. But I believe it's because there really isn't anything of any major significance to report, honestly. Zero abuse, no neglect, no bullying that I found, and there was nothing about an adult touching him inappropriately in his youth, nothing like that. If he had shown disturbing behaviors as a child, one would think that his schoolmates, his peers, someone would have come forward and said something like, you know, oh, yeah, he was weird, you know, yep, he was the weird kid. But I didn't find anything of any import. What I did find was that he was just a normal, highly intelligent kid. His parents encouraged him with regards to his education and whatever extracurricular activities that he took part in. They were at the very least comfortably middle class. Sources also agreed that he and his mother were, again, super, super close, bonded, loving. There were no reports of any clashing really with his stepfather or his siblings either. I do understand or read from bandmates' interviews that Ian and John, the stepfather, didn't always get, you know, see eye to eye about everything, but that there wasn't a general discord in the house. You know, it's a typical step-parent thing. Now, reading interviews with stepfather John all show that he did love Ian with his whole heart, and he did his best to fill the shoes of a positive father figure at least, though their personalities were different. John didn't approve of Ian's musical tastes and so on, but again, no real negative specifics. Ian found a love of singing from a young age, and his parents also supported this. Ian also, as he became an adolescent and into his teens, maintained that he would never drink or do drugs. In fact, he prided himself on this, and his parents were so thankful. I mean, I'm a parent. I can appreciate this. Interviews with his younger brother David show that David absolutely adored his big brother. Ian was a sibling really worth looking up to. In his teens, I couldn't find anything about him being particularly ornery, giving his parents any real worries or real stress outside of just normal teenage stuff. As far as I found, there were no friends or old girlfriends that came forward to have anything particularly negative to say. He truly seemed like a respectful, honest, intelligent, scholastically successful young'un who loved his mama dearly and had a healthy relationship, or at least a decent relationship, with his stepfather. He showed very pro-social behaviors, so on and so forth. But John later said, quote, "He was emphatic, as he was growing up through his teenage years, that he would never drink, never do drugs. That's what he told us," end quote. And really a parent's absolute dream. He loved American rock and American metal music, and hashtag samesies. And we will not be blaming what he did on this kind of music. We're not going there. And when he was in high school, he and Mike Lewis became friends, and eventually Mike would be the guitarist for the Lost Prophets. But again, straight A's, all around, decent teenager. As teenagers, Mike and Ian's love of rock and metal music just solidified their friendship. In 1991, they formed Aftermath, which was a thrash metal band that played in a shed at Watkins' house. And Aftermath never recorded any material. A former bandmate said that Ian lost his virginity at 15 years old at a party, and by 16, he was sleeping around with the area girls pretty regularly. It was said that he gained a lot of confidence to the point of being a bit arrogant, but not unmanageable, if you know what I mean. I mean, he was still said to be a nice guy. So, goes on, graduates from high school. There's really nothing left to say about his childhood. So, we'll peel back some of the layers and we'll see if we can see anything, right? We're going to open the briefcase and get the gold glow. His biological father died when he was 5. Okay, so as I said, I really wish that I could have found any more information about him aside from the fact that he did die from epilepsy. What kind of father was he? What kind of husband was he? Were there possibly less than desirable genetic traits that might have passed through? I don't know, and it really is bothering me. So even though there is no proof of this whatsoever, and I am in no way implying his paternal side had anything to do with what was going on whatsoever, it still got me thinking about genetic traits and if pedophilia or pedophilic tendencies can run in families. Now, I've studied this before, but it is always good to get a refresher, at least in our world, right? So I did a little research, and I found that epilepsy affects, for the most part, the temporal lobe, which plays a role in managing your emotions, processing information from your senses, storing and retrieving memories, and understanding language. It is involved in facial and object recognition, memory storage and recall, understanding language and expression, as well as emotional reactions and processing. So, studies have shown that disturbances of the temporal lobes can result in an increase in pedophilic behaviors or an increase in the breadth of deviant sexual interests. And it has been discovered that an increase in sexuality from temporal lobe disease can unmask latent pedophilia. PET findings, or PET findings, suggest a role for right temporal lobe dysfunction in some with pedophilia. So this is a stretch, right? A whole ass stretch. But I also found that in around 30 to 40% of cases, epilepsy can be genetic. So again, I'm not saying this is a thing, okay? I'm not. But what if Ian inherited some issue from his bio dad that affected his, you know, I don't know, temporal lobe portion of his brain? What do you think? I don't know. It's a stretch. Probably not. But I think that would be an interesting experiment, and I hope that that has been studied. Or did I just think it up? So before I hit my beloved DSM, I went to one of my most favorite sources, the National Library of Medicine, National Center for Biotechnology Information, an article titled, "Potential Implications of Research on Genetic or Heritable Contributions to Pedophilia for the Objects of Criminal Law." And this is what I read. Quote, "In recent years, There has been increasing scientific research on possible genetic or heritable influences to the ideology of pedophilia, driven by national and public concerns about better understanding the disorder in order to reduce children's vulnerabilities to pedophilic and child sex offenders. Pedophilia or pedophilic disorder is a paraphilic disorder and diagnosis defined by a persistent sexual attraction to children aged 13 and younger, the most recent diagnostic and statistical manual of mental disorders, the DSM-5, the Holy Grail, right? Defines the disorder as one where adults or adolescents 16 years of age or older have intense and recurrent sexual urges towards and fantasies about prepubescent children that they have either acted on or which cause them distress or interpersonal difficulty, end quote. So although the prevalence of pedophilia in the general population is of course not known, it is thought to be around 3-5%, and it has been reported to be much more common among males. And a lot of sources actually kind of vary on that. They go from there's no, like, less than 1% females, all the way up to that they're both equally in the same percentage. But the point is, the percentage is low. It's thought to be very low. It should definitely be studied more. Okay. So little scientific inquiry has been done concerning pedophilia until recently. In general, there has been a long-standing history of research surrounding genetics and potential causes of criminality, including research on the connection of men with XYY syndrome to criminal behavior and overrepresentations in prison populations in the 1960s. And then another study, one of my personal favorite studies, on the relationship between the presence of the MAOA gene and aggressive or criminal behavior in humans in the 1990s. Recent decades have been especially marked by a growth of academic dialogue on the relationship between genetics and criminal law, including discussions on how increased scientific understandings of genetic contributions, underpinnings, or predispositions to mental disorders, specific behaviors, or types of criminality may complicate or alter traditional approaches to criminal adjudication, crime prevention, and views on legal responsibility, punishment, and justice. That is a mouthful, but it's all very important. So the ideology of pedophilia remains, again, largely unknown, but the disorder is thought to be caused by an undetermined distribution of psychological, sociological, and biological factors. I mean, that's the most generic, great value brand statement they can say, honestly. And even though the biological facets of the disorder are still not really principally determined, and very few researchers study the causes of pedophilia, most scientists now consider the disorder as a complex, sort of deep-rooted predisposition, and over the last few decades have correspondingly begun to study possible biological associations to the etiology and presence of the disorder, such as abnormal brain structure and function, irregular hormone levels, biological vulnerabilities to environmental factors, and genetic influences. I mean, it's really nature and nurture. When you look at pedophilia, you know, and you're going to kind of, you can't really put people in a box. If you're going to put it in some kind of a box, I mean, you basically have nature and nurture, okay? Quote, "People don't choose what arouses them. They discover it," end quote, said Dr. Fred Berlin, director of the Johns Hopkins Sex and Gender Clinic. Quote, "No one grows up wanting to be a pedophile." But the article goes on to say that there has been very limited studies on this, but they have really finally begun in the last couple of decades or so, and the research is still ongoing. A summary of the 6 main studies explicitly suggesting genetic contributions to pedophilia and their findings are telling. One study said that just over 10% of pedophilic patients had first-degree male relatives with pedophilia. So first degree is going to be one dash away from you. So brother, dad, and then second degree is like uncle, cousin, that sort of thing. So anyway, but there's 0% of the control group, not pedophiles, who had first-degree male relatives with pedophilia. What that says is that if someone is a pedophile, there is a very statistically relevant, at least, chance that they have a male in their closer family who is also one. Another study out of the City of Hope National Medical in Duarte, California, found a highly significant positive connection to the presence of GTS genes in pedophilic patients. 18.5% of pedophilic patients admitted to having another pedophile in the family, compared to 3% of a psychiatric control group. And, you know, the GTS gene has things going on, right? But it also has some influence in people with Tourette's. And again, that does not mean I'm saying that people with Tourette's are pedophiles. I am not saying that. But many genes perform more than one job, in a sense. Now, in addition to the involvement of GTS genes in pedophilic behavior and possible heritability of the disorder, the study also suggests the development of sexual behavior, including pedophilia, is related to serotonin receptors and dopamine-related candidate genes. Yet another study coming out of Italy involved a 49-year-old male patient with a one-year-long history, so since he was 48, of being sexually attracted to his 9-year-old daughter, who then later developed frontotemporal dementia. So they decided to do a genetic sequence of this man, and they identified a mutation in the PGRN gene. That gene is connected to the regulation of cell growth, cell survival, cell repair, and cell inflammation. And in silico analysis, which is more computer-driven rather than testing on animals, right, suggested the damaging role of this gene mutation in prefrontal function and sexual behavior. This study relates to past findings concluding that pedophiles have poor prefrontal networks. And we all know how important that prefrontal cortex is with regards to self-regulating one's own behaviors and so on. Another study at the Sexual Behaviors Clinic at the Royal Ottawa Mental Health Care Center that constructed genograms for 5 different families by standardized family histories of sexual deviance. Families were identified by having at least 2 first or second degree relatives previously diagnosed with a sexual paraphilic disorder. The results found considerably higher rates of paraphilia and specifically pedophilia in families compared to rates based on population prevalence data. However, the results of this study were unable to differentiate if results were due to the effects of a shared environment or to genetics. But they concluded that the results suggested the familial transmission of homosexual and heterosexual pedophilia. It's just suggested. Okay. So the last study that I found is a Korean case study on monozygotic male twins with pedophilia. That's a hard word to say. Don't judge me. Twins. Okay. So findings showed both twins had extensive histories of sexual deviance and pedophilia. Twins had some differing experiences with environmental factors, including sexual abuse. So this study suggested that genetic influences and related genetic vulnerabilities appear to be more important to the causes and development of pedophilia than environmental factors, including childhood abuse. So I would say after all of those studies that there is at least some promising data leaning towards that there is a genetic situation going on, if you will. And there's other studies out there, but you get the point. All of that to say that I don't know if Ian's later behaviors might have had some level of genetic propensity because there was zero information about his bio dad, again, other than the epilepsy, and no real information about his mother's family. It can't be ruled out, but we also can't prove anything. So I said all of that, but it's kind of a dead end. Okay, but mother overindulged, which we already know negatively impacts the child. Just listen to my podcast on serial killer nurse Lucy Letby. So, you know, this might have had at least some impact or influence as well, that he was very coddled, okay? I'm not blaming Elaine, by the way. That is not mommy shaming. I'm just saying teeny tiny marginal contributing factor, perhaps. So genetics, we don't know. Environment, his environment really was enviable in a lot of ways. Relationships and whatnot seemed kind of normal. I mean, he might have been a little bit of a, you know, flirt, if you will, but I don't think outside of the realm of normal. You know, the backgrounds, it's kind of frustrating. Pedophilia is a paraphilia. I just did a true crime science episode on paraphilias, so go have a listen to that if you'd like. I think we are up to volume 7 or 8 on those. They're very popular, but regardless, it is a paraphilia. That means a person's sexual arousal and gratification depends on objects, activities, or even situations that are considered atypical. But whether we like it or not, and of course I don't, pedophilia is a psychological disorder. It is not a choice people consciously make. Paraphilias as a group have a high rate of comorbidity, or really having more than one specific paraphilia with one another, and an equally high rate of comorbidity with anxiety, major depression or mood disorders, and substance abuse disorders. That one in particular, I believe, was a situation with Ian. So the next question is, when did he know? When did it begin to occur to him that he would be sexually attracted to children? Well, the science says the age of onset for pedophilia comes before adulthood, often during adolescence. In some studies, a minority of these surveyed or those surveyed said that they identified the feelings prior to puberty. Now, there are other rare situations where there's been a traumatic brain injury or certain kinds of dementia and so on, but we are talking ones that didn't experience any of that. In other words, I would bet the farm that he knew as he was going through puberty. I just feel like it probably dawned on him. You know, he was intelligent. So walk with me here. Let's go for a walk, okay? You are a kid having this pretty decent childhood, things going pretty smoothly as they can. And as those hormones, you know, begin to shift and churn within you, your body growing rapidly, it feels strange and oddly foreign. Your emotions and thoughts all over the place as your awareness of the world becomes more adult-like. And you realize your sexual development as you've aged, the object of your growing attentions, even pre-attractions, but attentions, quickly turning into attraction, are still children. Imagine that just for a brief moment. Think about how you would feel. You've heard your entire life that yes, grown-ups who might be inappropriate with children are bad, and stay away from creepy Uncle So-and-so, right? Oh yes, I won't go near him, Mommy, I promise. And then you begin to realize that you are in fact that creepy guy. So what do you do with that? I can already hear people just saying, well, eat a bullet, right? I'll just throw that out there because I already know that that's what people are thinking. But outside of that, okay, what do you do? Do you go to mom and dad? You know, say, how was work today? My day was okay until I realized I wanted to do inappropriate things with children. What's for dinner? I mean, you're not going to do that. That's not happening. And because of this, because I know they are born that way and they can't help it at all, then I put my torch and my pitchfork away. I mean, it's still in the mental shed. Make no mistake. I have kids. This is not the least bit funny. What I would like to see happen, just a potential idea, not heavily thought about, okay, is where perhaps there could be like a hotline or some mental health providers who might offer their services in a, I don't know what they would call it, but in the law world I came from, pro bono, as a charity, you know, helping further science and let these people come to them under the cover of complete secrecy to get help. And if not help, at least answer questions for tests and research and things so that we can get a better idea of percentages and so on and so forth, right? If that help was absolutely anonymous, verified, safe, etc., then perhaps most, if not all, would come out of the shadows, talk to professionals to help them manage the stress of it, the shame, medications to do what medications do, to perhaps damper or end the sex drive, whatever it took. I don't know. I'm also just throwing that out there, you know. I don't necessarily think murder them all is always the answer. I don't want to say out loud that sometimes it is. Moving on. So enough about pedophilia. Ugh. We feel wholly certain that Ian knew by the time he was going through or hit the end of puberty, he knew. He knew. But he obviously told no one, and it makes his constant promises of never drinking or doing drugs make a teeny bit more sense, don't you think? He's smart. He would know that booze and drugs lower inhibitions, and as long as you maintain control over yourself, then you can get through most anything. A young, trying to think positively adolescent. Honorable, I guess. So after high school, Ian gets what is called a first-class honors degree in graphic design in college at the University of Wales, Newport. That's what we in the United States would call the equivalent of a bachelor's degree. Undergraduate, 4 years-ish. You get it. Again, impressive. By his age, I calculate that he graduated high school in 1995, so then one can say he graduated from college in 1999. He would have been about 22 years old. Okay. So remember his first band? Well, yeah, that band broke up, and the boys formed a new band called Fleshbind, based on sort of American hardcore punk influences. The band played several shows, including one supporting theater in London, but the group broke up. This happens in early rock bands. It's perfectly normal. He was in another band with his, you know, childhood pal Mike called Public Disturbance, but that one eventually broke up. The final form of all of this, long story short, is Lost Prophets. That's the name of their band. All of this just as he's graduating from college. So that's his music background timeline simplified. I know that he messed around on the drums too, but full lead singer. So the Lost Prophets put out their debut album in 1997. Sources stated that Ian actually started out as the drummer, but quickly moved to the lead vocals. Their first album, The Fake Sound of Progress, was recorded with just 6,000 pounds, which is not, but pretty comparable, you know, to the US dollar. The album was originally intended as a sort of glorified demo, but after catching the attention of several major labels, the band re-recorded and re-released the album on a much wider scale through Columbia Records. That is a big deal. When the second album was finally released, the band found more success, entering the UK album chart at number 5, and this introduced the band to a wider audience, achieving a modicum of international popularity, most notably in the United States, and for UK bands, that's always been kind of hard. Their third album was released in June 2006 in the UK and entered the UK album chart at number 1. This is an achievement that many, many bands would only ever hope to achieve. They toured, they gained more fame, began playing the festivals back in the early 2000s, you remember? Including like Vans Warped Tour, Ozfest, and Glastonbury, and opened for bands like Disturbed and Linkin Park. And if you don't listen to those bands or you've never heard of them, you don't listen to heavier music, this just means that they were getting very famous. In the rock and metal world, these are very big, everyone recognizes names. So again, big deal. If you listened to a mainstream rock radio station back in the early 2000s, chances are you've heard them. And in fact, as much as I hate to do it. So here is a very small clip of one of their popular songs. It's just like 5 seconds, so that no one gives this man any fucking money to look him up on YouTube. Because if you look him up and watch anything or you listen to anything, he's still going to make money off of that. So don't, okay? Here's the little blip. So 0 views, 0 listens for him. As I said, he'd make money off it, so just don't. But regardless, his band got quite famous, and with a rather rapid rise to such success came with it the drug use and alcohol he had always promised he'd never do. The unimaginable tidal waves of adoration, you know, imagine, and obsession, and unfortunately, he was also considered quite handsome and charming. And as we all know, what drives most of that, who's going to get, who's going to be giving attention to that are teenage girls. They are like these beautiful, just stunning little moths to a flame. It is inevitable. And the perpetual adoration and keeping the ego in check, well, from what I've heard, that becomes very shaky ground. The drug use, as far as I could find, began in 2007 when he was 30 years old. And if that really is the case, he held on to his promise a good while. I mean, considering the usual age of rock and roll debauchery. He very quickly became addicted, and it was said that he used hard drugs, as in hard. The girls he dated spoke about a, quote, voracious sexual appetite he developed quickly. That turned into him having his regular girls in different cities, and so on. The drug spiral was swift and deep, and then he would tell his bandmates, you know, oh, no, I'm going to get clean, I'm going to be okay, and he would be, for a short while, and then back down the drug hole he would go. And then he got to where he was seen selling said drugs to the young fans backstage. He would at some point say this is how he kind of helped afford his habit, but more than likely, if you really take a look behind the curtain, it was most likely for the joy of being surrounded by very young fans. Because make no mistake, at this point, he was already sleeping with underage girls. The band would also later find out that he was using their official MySpace page to, quote, arrange his trysts. They were horrified. His former and very happily ex-bandmate and bassist, Stewart, told the PRP News, quote, I don't think many people know this, but before the band broke up, there was a show on Warped Tour towards the end of 2009 to 2011. We realized Ian had a depressingly sad drug addiction. It just snuck up on us because, unfortunately, we were living in LA and he was living back home in Wales. We didn't see him fucking 9 months of the year, and we realized how bad it was, and we had an intervention with him, and we said, look, if you don't clean up your act, you're fucking out. This band is done. So in 2012, he finally got his shit together, and we went on Warped Tour, and he was sober, and he was singing better than he'd ever sung in his life, end quote. As Richardson later went on to confirm, Watkins' sobriety did not last. Reflecting back on a particularly poor performance Watkins delivered of the band's album Start Something in Cardiff, Richardson commented, quote, I've never been so embarrassed in my life as playing that show. He didn't move for the whole set, sung the wrong words. It was like, this is our fucking legacy. This is supposed to be the thing we're remembered for, and you want to set up our future by doing this badly? This fucking sucks. End quote. So we all wanted to quit after that show. We were like, look, you gotta figure your fucking shit out. Otherwise, you're fucking out of here. End quote. Apologies for so many F-bombs. I'm just doing the quote. Although I'm pretty sweary, let's be honest. So it appears that his harder drugs of choice were cocaine, which then morphed into methamphetamine. Oh yes, Mr. Meth. His bandmates said he just wouldn't sleep, and he would become very, very manic. And it most assuredly amped his sex drive up, so let's take a moment to look at that aspect, right? An article written for Johns Hopkins titled Study Explores Like Between Methamphetamine Use and Risky Sexual Behavior, okay? The article said, quote, recreational use of the illicit drug methamphetamine has long been associated with increases in overall impatient and risky behavior. Now, a new study by Johns Hopkins medicine researchers confirms that meth use increases many things. One of the more serious one is sexual desire. And side note, this is not me telling anyone to use meth to increase your libido. I swear to God. Okay? I swear to God. So people engage in risky behaviors in association with these drugs and sex, which is largely connected with the concept of delayed discounting, or the degree to which people take the future into account in their decision making. End quote. So drug use can and often impacts sexual function. Some drug addicts confessed to turning to pedophilia when amphetamines left them, quote, sexually disinhibited. That was only one source, though. I read another study titled Sexual Behavior Among Male Methamphetamine and Heroin Dependents Attending Drug Rehabilitation Clinic, and it said, quote, a study of a sample of crystal methamphetamine users in Sydney found that users reported benefits such as alertness, increased energy, aphrodisiac effects, sociability, euphoria, and loss of inhibitions, end quote. So, inhibitions, right? Which is part of his probably trying to steer clear of his predilection of children. It is indeed unwise to lower your sexual inhibitions when you know that there is a part of you that, you know, perhaps you can't help, that is sexually attracted to unacceptable subjects, subjects who cannot consent. He should have kept his promise of not doing drugs. And because his drug abuse began in 2007, at most sources agree that it was about 2007, 30th birthday, you know, coincides with our first evidence of his unspeakable crimes. Now remember, he's already sleeping with teenage girls. He was 30 in 2007. Okay. So here's where I will remind you very quickly that I'm about to get into these intense. This information is extremely upsetting, okay? I will be respectful with my wording to the victims because I'm not describing this out for anyone who might get off on it. I use words that are boring on purpose. A girl that he had been dating when all of this began stated that his judgment went out the window when the drugs started. She said that she read that sex addiction is a problem when sex comes before work or is affecting your day-to-day life, and that's what he was like. He would literally not turn up to writing sessions because of sex. So in 2006, Ian had begun demanding his own private dressing room while out on tour, and this is believed to be where the sexual assaults of minors were happening for the most part. 2007 is where the court documents began addressing the pedophilia. The following information is from his sentencing report. Some of the information I will read directly from the document. Buckle up, deep breath, names have been abbreviated. Other than Ian's, he's a piece of shit, he doesn't deserve anonymity. March 2007, Ian met TT after a Lost Prophets concert when she was a 16-year-old virgin. The prospect of taking her virginity excited him. He got her to dress in a schoolgirl's outfit, and he videoed her and him having oral, vaginal, and anal sex. He asked her whether she enjoyed being his underage slut. At the end, he urinated all over her face and told her to consume. August 2008. As Ian would find out, his mother was suffering with kidney disease that was very, very serious. It was said that he was stressed and he was worried about her. And yet, the girl KJ was another fan, aged 16. He videoed her having oral sex with him. She was observed snorting white powder, which he told her was cocaine. B, the letter B as in boy, was only 19 when she met Watkins in late 2011. The communications between the two of them in March and April of 2012 are seriously disturbing. Her infant was only 10 months old. For reference, those who have never had kids or don't know, most 10-month-olds are crawling, beginning to pull up and stand with assistance, maybe even taking those first tentative steps, right? So B had detailed discussions with Watkins about the sexual acts to which the two of them were going to subject her infant. She later told the police she met up with Ian at the Copthorne Hotel in Cardiff in South Wales. Ian says, quote, come down this weekend and we can fuck him up again. She texted back saying, tell me if you want to get your in our boy. She had previously referred to getting her boy high on ice, i.e. methamphetamine. This was what led up to the session at the Key West Hotel in London on the night of the 2nd and the 3rd, April 2012, recorded on the video. He loved videoing himself having sex with whoever, whatever. In this recording, she presented her baby to him so that he could try to R-word him. first in his oral cavity and then the other. Watkins can be seen spitting, blah, blah, blah. The young mother can be heard and seen encouraging him. She placed her baby boys, you know, in her mouth and did the thing. She then took the boy's hand and put it on her own private area. Ian then messed with the boy's genitalia. The judge stated, quote, "The planning and graphic detail are bad enough. The videoing of what you both were doing is an aggravating factor. The enjoyment both of you can get... No, the enjoyment both of you can be seen to derive from what you were doing is both sickening and incomprehensible." End quote. And then a month later, in May, she sent Ian a message saying, "The boy is ready to be abused." The next month, in June 2012, Ian was arrested for various drug charges, and he was granted bail pretty quickly. I'm sure he had money. But by this point, he was on Welsh law enforcement's radar because apparently several of his friends reported that he was regularly smuggling cocaine and meth in from LA. So again, that was June 2012. So August 2nd, 2012, his message back to her is, quote, "To be honest, though, I think we have gone easy on him so far. Time to teach him and make, all caps, him learn to love it." End quote. The evidence indicates she took her baby and she met Ian at the Maldron Hotel in Cardiff. Then on September 9th, so 1 month after that, she sent Ian a photo of herself putting her mouth where it doesn't belong. Now, also that same August, he met and began chatting with another young mother referred to as P, as in Paul, in court documents. There was talk of moving in together. Ian said, quote, "If you belong to me, so does your baby." She responded, "Understandable. A mother-daughter-slave duo worshiping you." Ian said, quote, "That's all she will know, a life of filth." P said, "The good thing about babies is put anything near their mouths and they will start S-wording it." She went on to talk about both her and her baby sharing Ian's genital areas with their mouths. The judge said, quote, "The subsequent communications planning even more depraved activities for this little girl, including forcing her to engage in sex with animals and how to take drugs, defy belief." Ian referred to this little girl as, quote, "my little fuck toy." He stated he could not wait to get mother and daughter taking crack cocaine. He spoke of whoring the female baby out to fat old men who would pay thousands. Ian texted, quote, "She needs to know mummy and daddy don't love her. She is just there to make us finish." Ian spoke of torturing her for fun. P took photos of the little girl's genitalia and sent them to Ian. P inserted things from her own phalanges where they don't belong and sent a photo of that and similar images to Ian. His response was to say he could not wait to stretch her. A split screen Skype session on the 12th of December 2012 is again very disturbing viewing and listening. Ian encouraged P, as in Paul, to spit on her finger and blah, blah, blah. P did just that with apparent enjoyment. Ian was self-servicing while he was watching. P took her infant to meet with Ian at the Travelodge north of Cardiff on the October 2nd and or at the Radisson in Cardiff on the 23rd of October. This is all in 2012. What happened that time was apparently not recorded. And again, he recorded a lot. What is known is that P accepted that the two of them agreed that the little girl should be R-worded by Ian, and they both intended that that should take place. Ian initiated and orchestrated the appalling abuse. So, he would perform his last show with his band in November 2012. So, you know. He was then arrested for drug possession. Sorry, these pauses are because this material is horrible. So he was arrested for drug possession, right? And on the allegation that he possessed highly unacceptable child media stuff. He, of course, pled not guilty and he was granted bail. Or he pleaded not guilty and was granted bail again. A third arrest happened a month later in December 2012 due to another drug possession. Only this time, the South Wales police got a warrant to search his home and his computer. And it was during this search that the officers found numerous indecent images of children saved on his computer. He was immediately charged with conspiracy to engage in sexual activity with a 1-year-old girl and possession and or distribution of indecent images of children and, quote, extreme animal pornography, this being, of course, bestiality. The two girls with the children in the court documents were also arrested and held. He denied the accusations because, of course, he did. His trial started in June 2013, and by November, he pleaded guilty to attempted rape and sexual assault of a child under 13, but not guilty of rape. He pleaded guilty to 3 counts of sexual assault involving children, 6 counts of taking, making, possessing indecent images of children, and 1 count of possessing an extreme pornographic image involving a sex act on an animal. The encrypted password he used on his computer was, and I quote, "I fuck kids." So the day after his guilty plea was accepted by the prosecution, well, he then referred to his sex crimes as, quote, "mega lols," L-O-L-Z, laugh out loud, okay, for those who might not know what lols means. Mega lols in a recorded phone call to a female fan. He even said that he didn't really understand what all the fuss was about. He was sentenced to basically 30 years. The other two girls, B and P, less than 20 years each. During the sentencing, the judge quoted from Watkins's pre-sentence report, prepared following an interview with Ian in custody. Quote, "You spoke of your desire to shock and your craving to push sexual boundaries. This craving was fueled by your use of cocaine and methamphetamine, which increased your sexual aggression. You spoke of not knowing to what extremes you would have gone but for your arrest." End quote. The report also makes the following assessment. Quote, "The child victims in this case appear to be coincidental to his need to dominate and to test out the extent to which his sexual partners would collude and participate in his sexual interests." Now, I agree with his desire for control in that aspect, absolutely, but I feel very strongly that he had to have been sexually attracted to children on some level prior to the drugs. The drugs just took the last bit of impulse control away so that he could indulge, but of course, that is my rather, but I would like to brag a little, educated opinion. So he later bragged that he had sexually assaulted a 5-year-old little girl in the United States. He took pride in saying girls over 20 were just too old. He continued to write letters to young mothers from prison until he was caught doing that, and one of them got their kid taken away as well. The letters were demanding and degrading and just begging. It's disgusting. Ian's boasted about working as a prostitute in London through escort website Adult Work before he was arrested or put away. According to thesun.co.uk, quote, "The disgraced star ran a profile under the name Fuck Nasty Fuck You and posted pictures of himself having sex with women and men. In one letter, he wrote, quote, "My AW, meaning Adult Work, location was London, where there was always more work there and way more fun. If you can't find it, then a lot of pics from it are still online in other places, too." So the last bit of time his bandmates would see him, one said, quote, "He was disgusting, so messed up. He was starting to have issues with his teeth falling out and rotting. He let his hygiene go. He was never showering. He looked bloated and unhealthy, and his skin was getting bad. All the things he said he wouldn't let happen were starting to happen. it got to the point where he couldn't sleep without taking this powder that bodybuilders use to sleep because they get so hyped working out. He would take too much of that and pass out, and I would try and wake him to get him to come to sound check, and he'd be like a log. It was just horrible to watch. End quote. The band disbanded, and of course they did, and I want to state officially for the record that I believe his bandmates didn't know. They admit they knew about the drugs, which are unfortunately common in much of the entertainment industry. But I feel pretty confident that they knew that he might have been being inappropriate with 16, 17-year-old fans after shows and whatnot, which is admittedly bad, but I do not under any circumstances believe that they knew the depths of his depravity. Some of them were married with their own kids, you know? Ian withdrew into his little disgusting, perverted fantasy world, and he kept himself on an entirely different continent from his bandmates for 9 to 10 months out of the year, even. It makes me sad to hear the other boys were getting death threats, because I just hope that the rest of the bandmates have found some level of peace. So if any of you happen to be listening, I believe you. I speak no ill will. So Ian's nearly lifelong friend Mike later gave an interview where he said, quote, "I tried reading the judge's report," which is, side note, kind of the, it was the really gross stuff that I had to read to you. And he said, "I couldn't even finish it." He played guitar for Lost Prophets and has known Ian since they were kids. Quote, "To think that somebody I grew up with, who I had been friends with my entire life, whose mother I knew, and how close our families were, to even imagine him, I find it utterly unbelievable that he was capable of doing those things. Obviously he did, but how somebody can," and then it says his voice trailed off, "I don't understand it, I'm afraid." "There was absolutely nothing that led us to suspect what he had done," agrees Lee, who played guitar in the band. "I think he created such a smokescreen. I hate to rely on cliches, but when you see the profile of a pedophile, he couldn't be any further from it. He was always surrounded by all these women, so it just seemed impossible." Ian's own brother stated, quote, "When I was in high school, it was awesome. I thought all the attention was great. I was naive. I don't want to be known as the brother of Ian Watkins," end quote. So let's all collectively decide to leave his siblings and his parents alone. And the bandmates, honestly, they should be on that list as well. I certainly don't blame his brother for not wanting to be Ian Watkins' brother. His stepfather said that he would happily throw him around a cell, but that he and Elaine were not going to give up on their son. So the update, something that happened recently, which is what jogged my memory about this case, which then got me sending it to the patrons on a poll to vote for, on the morning of August 5th, 2023, so less than a year ago, Watkins was taken hostage by three other inmates at HM Prison Wakefield and was freed by prison officers 6 hours later. Police later confirmed his injuries were not life-threatening, and that's most unfortunate. The inmates grabbed him and drug him into a cell where they beat the hell out of him and stabbed him multiple times. He's still rotting away in jail, though. So, the experts are all saying, you know, no empathy, no shame, no rehabilitation, since we know he was still trying to get young mothers to send disgusting photos to him. This guy gives me Albert Fish vibes, maybe not with, you know, minus the cannibalism, of course. And I, quite honestly, I don't really want to talk about Ian Watkins ever again, honestly. And the thing is that although my memory kind of had to be jogged, I do remember the Lost Prophets. Their music was more kind of pop rockish to me. Now, I only remember a couple of songs, and I'm not going to give him the revenue to go, you know, walk down memory lane. I know that some sources say they were thrash metal, but it very much felt kind of pop rock to me. That's not really my style. I listen to the kind of heavier stuff, but I certainly didn't hate the band. Like, if the song was on, I wasn't going to change the station. You get what I'm saying? At least it wasn't country music. I'm sorry. I know some of you love it. I know. I'm sorry. So, that was horrific. Tell me, guys, what do you think about the case? What do you think? It's just so hard to believe that... I mean, no childhood is perfect, right? No childhood is absolutely perfect. And sure, I can kind of get a sense that maybe him and his stepdad would clash heads ever so slightly, but his dad died when he was five, when Ian was five. Most of us can only remember or have sort of tiny little, you know, Polaroid pictures of memories in our minds from 5, 4 years old, you know. The hurt might be there, but, you know, I lost a father at 8. And so, you know, yeah, it will roll back over you, but it doesn't consume your life. And one of his bandmates talked about how when they were, you know, right before all this kind of came out, that their father died, and Ian never talked about his biological father, but he did say, hey, I know what it's like to lose a parent. My real dad died. But, I mean, he didn't seem overly sad about it. Like, he seemed well-adjusted. He had a mother that absolutely doted on him, loved him, a stepfather that tried to be there for him, be good to him, at least be civil, have a friendship father figure-ish thing. Sounds like he was bandmates with a great group of guys, you know? Oh my God, Vans Warped Tour. For this, what happened? Was it, do you believe that it was just the drugs? I don't. I think it was already there. I feel very strongly that it was already there, and the drugs killed his impulse control, his inhibitions. But tell me what you think regardless, you know? Leave me a comment. Always feel free to leave me a comment. I love to read them, even the nasty ones. You know who you are, trolls, because a listen is still a listen. Win is a win. You can DM me on Instagram, @serial_killing. You can come join us on the Serial Killing, a podcast fan page on Facebook that was created by a beloved listener. I've got another kind of big episode like Mommy Issues in the works. It's not done yet, but we're getting there. So look forward to that. And outside of that, thank you so much for listening, guys, because I know you could be listening to anyone else, but you chose me. And I really appreciate that. Thank you so much, guys. Have a great day.
Anybody who killed more than 2 or 3 people was a mass murderer. And whether it was all at one place or over an extended period of time, and then in the early 80s, they came up with this differentiation called serial killing.